I wanted to start by showing you a clip from, like, you know how Documenta, you could relate anything back to Documenta, Dorothea Fine? I can relate anything back to Adventure Time. I mean, this is a really important cultural event for me. So I was going to show you an opening scene from a episode of season 2 of Adventure Time, an episode called Video Makers, where our heroes, Finn the human and Jake the dog, are starting a film club, and they are projecting, like, their friends come over, and the screen comes up, they're going to project a film, and one of their friends says, wait, like, what's that screen say? And they say, oh, it's nothing, all of our movies have this, it seems pretty important, we better read it. And what they read is the FBI anti-piracy warning frame that is at the front of all of your DVDs and things like that. And so the scene immediately, it ends, and you just see everyone leaving, and they say, sorry, well, we can't have a film club, we didn't realize that we were showing illicit screenings. It's an episode really structured around, let's say, the invisible frame of intellectual property law and copyright. And it, trust me, if I could have shown this to you, it would provide an oddly suitable introduction to the three works by Pierre that I want to consider with you briefly this morning. And essentially, I'm going to try to talk a little bit with you about a three-year period in the late 1990s and three projects that really mark that time frame, among others that Pierre was making. So maybe let's just talk about what three works I'm going to discuss with you today. I want to talk a little bit about Blanche-Neige Lucie of 1997. It's a very straightforward work, a four-minute film centered around this person, Lucie Dolan, who she's a dubbing actress and singer and things like that, but she dubbed a number of Disney movies in France in the 1960s and onwards, including, most famously, Snow White. She was the voice of Snow White in its 62 version. And this is a work in which she's discussing an attempt to regain her voice, let's say. She's actually in the middle of a lawsuit against Disney Corporation at this time in the late 90s, mid 90s, where she was paid just a very simple lump sum for the dubbing, and is trying to gain rights to royalties from it. So what we have, she's sitting on an empty soundstage. She is humming the tune Someday My Prince Will Come, and running across the screen is an interview. We read the subtitles, which is an interview of her explaining this case, this lawsuit. So I want to talk a little bit about Blanche-Neige Lucie with you. I want to talk a bit about The Third Memory, a rather more complex work of 1999. This is a 10-minute-long dual-screen video installation, which takes up the story of the protagonist of Dog Day, the film Dog Day Afternoon, John Wojtowicz, whose infamous bank robbery in New York in the 1970s became the basis for the film version starring Al Pacino. And again, it's, let's say, framed in many ways as a tale of Wojtowicz reclaiming his identity from the spectacle machine of Hollywood. And lastly, I want to think a bit about the Ann Lee project, which encompasses a range of videos, two of them by Pierre himself, which used this manga character, which Pierre and Philippe Perrino had purchased from a Japanese company in 2000, and then, gifted to a number of artists to make works from over about a two-year period. She was retired from this in 2002. So, I mean, and again, often sort of seen as a liberation of this stock character who was kind of trapped in her corporatized identity. Obviously, you know I'm gonna, like, I'm gonna completely take apart that reading over the next, 15 minutes or something like that, right? What I want to say is something like, all of these works are similarly structured around intellectual property and proprietary rights that are generally kept invisible or off-screen, let's say. And I want to think a bit about that as a structuring principle. But maybe we should just begin by thinking a bit more about Blanche-Neige, Lucy, Snow White, Lucy. I said a little bit about the interesting relation Pierre sets up between image, sound, and subtitles. And I think what's really important about this is that we never actually hear her speaking. We are only hearing her hum this kind of famous Disney tune. As we read the subtitles, we're kind of recreating her voice in our heads. In a sense, we're replicating her own labor. We dub the sound to this work as we repeat her words in our minds. I mean, it's a film that's all about the voiceover, the unseen narrator, in French, the voix off, right? And maybe one way we can think about the relationship of sound and meaning in this work is to go back to an old term, a term from kind of the birth of contemporary media studies in Toronto in the mid-60s, in the kind of circle of Marshall McLuhan and all these guys. I'm thinking of a term invented by R. Murray Schafer, who's a kind of early sound studies person. He invented this neologism called schizophonia. Right? And Schafer was really interested in this technical condition of a sound that's been split off from its source, as in a voice split from a body, language split from its reality, from the social and cultural reality of its speakers and their environment. Schafer was really interested in exploring this schism and saw it as fundamentally unsettling or disturbing. Right? This notion of a sound that's been dissociated from its cause and its context. He really thought about this as a condition inherent in a 20th century soundscape. That it was part of the nature of electroacoustical transmission, that sounds would be split from their sources. For him, it was an aspect of our modern soundscape that he linked with what he saw as the increasing alienation of people living in a modern sound environment, that we lived in a schizophrenic condition. This notion of acoustic dissociation, and obviously I think we're meant to rhyme schizophrenia with the kinds of dissociation that we associate with schizophrenia, right? A kind of sound version of that same psychic dissociation. And he was, for Schafer, he was fundamentally interested in re-stitching our sonic environments, linking sounds and contexts together again, sort of a healing of that alienation. We can say that he's trying to diagnose a kind of, let's call it a deterritorialization of sound in the 20th century. I mean, if you want to maybe place it, to rhyme his schizophrenia with the kind of schizes that Deleuze and Guattari were going to address in their own study of the condition of late capital. And I think, schizophrenia is an interesting term for us to bring to bear on these works of the mid-1990s. I think it provides us with a set of questions about how to read Pierre's work at this time. I mean, was something like Blanche-Neige, Lucy, an issue of an examination of how to restore or recuperate agency in know, to is this a tale, and I think generally it's often been written about as a tale of re-territorializing sound, linking sound back to its origin in this particular body, the tale of Lucie Dolan is seen as one of her reclaiming the rights to her own sound, which had been taken from her by a corporation. But I think that's wrong reading. I think that fundamentally misunderstands the import of this work. I mean, in fact, I think we could say that Pierre's task here is precisely the opposite. It's a task of exacerbating schizophrenia, exacerbating dissociation, precisely pursuing deterritorialization even further. You know, and we have to think about the experience of this work again, this notion that you're hearing her low humming of this tune, Someday My Prince Will Come, as we read her interview, hearing her voice in our heads, dub sound once again. So the voice is torn even further away. But I think it's also important to consider what exactly the story that she's telling us is. Because the story itself, even, is not really one of the return of a voice. It's not one of a restoration. Rather, we need to remind ourselves that this is, in fact, a story of a lawsuit. She is suing Disney over royalties that she believed she was owed. It's a story about money, fundamentally, and copyright. And the context, I think, is important. Her lawsuit had its origins in a broader moment of struggle, a strike at the end of 1994. And I guess, for those of you who are thinking about France in those years, you know that 94-95 was a period of widespread labor unrest. But there was a long and rather brutal strike, they're not coal miners, but of acteurs doubleurs, the dubbing actors in France went on strike at the end of 94, and it was about a 4 or 5 month long strike. Again, in a dispute over intellectual property code, which in France drew a distinction between what they called artiste interprète and artiste de complément. In other words, performers versus essentially bit players. And this was a matter of how you got paid. It was an issue of compensation, whether you got royalties or simply a fixed sum. And the people like Lucie Dolan, who dubbed sound for movies, were considered artistes de complément, and simply paid by the hour. This was a strike, again, less over the rights to a voice or to a claim of a subject than a claim over money. These dubbing artists were seen as mere... This is where it becomes interesting, I suppose. These dubbing artists were seen as mere executants of a text, not interpreters of it. I mean, this is where I think the interest begins to lie. Their job, in a sense, entailed the subject being wholly subsumed into other beings, other forms of life. And I think Pierre, it seems to me, was precisely fascinated by this. Not by the restoration of agency, but by the intertwined condition of, on the one hand, this legal, juridical, and economic code of intellectual property, a newly dominant form of commodity in the late 20th century, and this interlinked subsumption of the subject into a role. I mean, something that entails that I think goes beyond mere alienation, the kinds of terms that a Marxist critical theory provided for understanding what happens in the labor process in the factory. And I think when we reach this moment where the factory is no longer simply a determinate physical site, but rather it is located within the body and psyche of the subject itself, alienation is perhaps no longer an adequate term. And this schizophrenia becomes a constitutive force in the late 20th century. And indeed, I mean, there's a wonderful article that appears on this strike in 94 in a French newspaper, where it opens with an account of, like, what happens to all these television characters when they can't work, you know? Like, when these shows, these American television shows, which are not being dubbed, and it's this question of, like, you know, what is Columbo doing, you know, and now that he can't, you know, he can't speak in French, and, you know, Starsky and Hutch are, like, you know, just, like, hanging out in the garage because they can't take their car out anymore. There's this, you know, notion of characters having this odd other life off screen. But I wanted to say maybe one more word by way of closing about Lucie Dolan, because... even beyond this tale of Snow White and the restoration of you know, her voice in that film, I think it's important to note that the capital relation is even deeper. That Lucie Dolan is simply a stage name. She's someone from the Ardèche in France. Was discovered by a popular radio host in the 1940s and brought to Paris. Her regional accent trained out of her. Her name changed to something more suitable for show business. That, you know, already long before this tale of Disney robbing her of a right to a voice, she had already lost a voice, already transformed. And one should just note that the outcome of her lawsuit, which again did not result in the restoration of a voice, it resulted in a $20,000 payment to her by Disney in recognition of royalties accrued. But Disney... Disney, they're such a great company. Disney, because they were concerned about having to pay future royalties to Lucie Dolan two years after this film was made by Pierre in 1999, Disney redubbed Snow White with a different voice, so they would not have to worry about Lucie's lawsuit any longer. So in fact, the only place we can hear her as Snow White is in this film. It's the, you know, now if you go take your kid to see Snow White in Paris, you'll hear something entirely other. I said I was going to say a few words as well. Oh, there she is. This is a record of hers from the late 1950s. I said I was going to say a few words about The Third Memory as well. This piece in which Pierre tracks down John Poitowitz, who led this famously failed bank robbery in the chaotic New York of the 1970s, and has him kind of retell this tale. And again, this is a work that's often interpreted as Poitowitz reasserting his story against its theft by a culture industry, and you know, Pierre talks about this as he says, you know, it's my most didactic work, right? He says, I think, you know, you could screen it in the education department at museums all around the world, you know. But I think we should be careful about. I mean, indeed, it is a didactic work, but I think we probably need to be careful about asking just what the lesson is that it tells us. Because any kind of careful examination of the film makes incredibly clear that John Wojtowicz himself has a very difficult time distinguishing between his actions as a subject and his own filmic representation. For him, 25 odd years on from the bank robbery, from its retelling in Hollywood, the lines between his character and his subjectivity have become absolutely blurred, and the identifications are between the two are complex and run very, very deep. And indeed, you can see kind of some stills, but what's important is to note that the work isn't simply, I mean, I think we have to be careful, it's not simply this two-channel video, but also a kind of accompanying installation, which includes things like the original film poster from Dog Day Afternoon, copies of the script, and other press clippings from the time. It's a work that is fundamentally about the necessary mediation and mediatization of these tales. And when you come into the Artist Institute today, you notice that there's a little resume posted up by the front desk, Pierre Joseph's resume. And I think an artist that we do well to remind ourselves of here, and I'm sure when we talk about Host in the Cloud, we might hear a little bit about Pierre Joseph as well, because one of his famous pieces is kind of restaged in the film. But Pierre Joseph was, part of this group of artists coming of age in the late 1980s and early 1990s in France, precisely interested in activating characters in the way that characters from movies, fairy tales, and the like become subjects, become animated. And I think Joseph's ghost, let's say, haunts all of these three works. And maybe we can just say a couple of words about the Anne Lee Project, which again is a very basic manga character created by a Japanese corporation, which I think Pierre and Philippe are attracted to precisely for its stripped down quality. She's not someone with a backstory, be a bit player in any film. They purchased the rights to her. And again, often we hear this work talked about as an attempt to restore some form of agency to this piece of computer code. But I would again ask that we consider it not in terms of subjectivizing a commodity, but rather of exploring this strange new condition, new forms that are seemingly neither living nor dead. And of course, that indeterminate state might sound familiar. I mean, the commodity has always existed in this strange space between the living and the dead, this kind of uncanny quality. But it seems to me that Pierre has been asking, was concerned with asking in the later 1990s, how does the commodity feel in an era of cognitive capitalism? In an essay I wrote a number of years ago, I called Pierre a phenomenologist of this topsy-turvy world, to quote a phrase from Marx's characterization of 1867. And I suppose I would certainly stand by that description of Pierre's efforts. Although I would maybe say that in the intervening years for me, it's become even clearer that Pierre is not so much interested in critique of this world, but rather in simply attempting to find a language to describe it. I mean, I think of Pierre is someone rather like, this is sort of romantic, but I can't resist. I mean, it's a little like Friedrich Engels in Manchester in 1844. Right? Engels, who as a young man is going to work in one of his father's factories in Manchester and instead spends his time wandering the streets of this strange new industrial world, exploring these disturbing juxtapositions of factory and slum, wealth and poverty, and writes a book, The Condition of the Working Class in England in 1844. That is one of the great poems, I think, of the 19th century, a poem that is aiming above all else to find a language adequate to a fundamentally new set of experiences. And I think Pierre, in many ways, was trying to do the same for another moment of transition, another moment of the shaping of a new relation of space, subject, and capital. You know, we know that since the mid-1990s, he's become ever more interested in the idea of ecosystems and complicated, strange ecosystems that that we live in. And I think that was true even here. We could see these works as precisely explorations of ecosystems created by forms of intellectual property and the subjectivities entailed. You know, that intellectual property law creates a whole new category of commodities that ask us to believe in them, right? To invest in them, to be affectively engaged with them. You know, that we need to believe in their lives outside of us, outside of our use of them. When Tino Segal reactivated Ann Lee 2 years ago, decade or so after her death in 2002, the reactivation ends with a question, right? Those who can correct me if I'm getting it wrong, but something like, what's the relationship between the sign and melancholia? And I suppose that is a question that seems like it has an easy answer. Something like, well, it's a relation of absence, right? But I would want to ask whose absence? I'm curious about whether it's precisely our own absence in the sign that might be the answer to that question. All three of these works, I would say, are what Pierre has called capitalist fairy tales, and I think we should hear both sides of that term. They are fairy tales. They are stories that attempt to explain a world to us. Stories that affectively engage us, but they are fundamentally stories about money, not about authenticity. Not about the restoration of subjective agency, but about this strange new category of being. And maybe I'll end there with you today. Thank you.